The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
He, at a rally in Pennsylvania before the 2016 election, urged a crowd to go to Philadelphia to monitor the polls to prevent the election from being stolen. First, I think the racial subtext here is significant. He was talking to a white crowd, and he was talking about polling stations in predominantly black communities. That the historical echoes are deafening when it comes to folks setting up a presence at the polls that's intended to deter minority voters from turning out. And that is classic voter intimidation. In many cases, it may already be unlawful if any of his supporters were to actually listen to him and go to the polls with that intention in mind. And it's also in this overheated political climate with the amount of political violence that we've seen in recent times really dangerous.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 24th, 2019. In a recent white paper, the organization Protect Democracy makes the case that President Trump has used the powers of the presidency, federal resources, and intimidating rhetoric to manipulate election outcomes in the United States. The paper argues that the answer to this behavior is congressional action, and offers recommendations for legislation on six issues, ranging from preventing voter intimidation to requiring campaigns to disclose offers of financial assistance. And Jessica Marsden, counsel for Protect Democracy, sat down to discuss it all with Benjamin Wittes. For full disclosure, Protect Democracy has represented Lawfare editors Benjamin Wittes, Jack Goldsmith, Scott Anderson, and Susan Hennessy on a number of matters. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 446, Jessica Marsden on new proposals for protecting democracy.
So I want to start by asking you to give us an overview of the problem that this white paper is responding to, why you guys put it together, and why you think there is a particular need for a policy response right now to, as you put it in the subtitle of the report, quote, prevent a corrupt politician from tipping the playing field in his own election.
Sure. So I think we've seen President Trump make a number of statements and take actions over the past 2 years that show his intent to call into question the validity of elections, and especially of election outcomes that don't favor himself or the Republican Party. We saw this almost as soon as he was elected, when he started to suggest that he would have won the popular vote, but for all of these supposed illegal votes that went to Hillary Clinton. We saw it again last fall when he made a number of false accusations on Twitter about misconduct in the vote counting process in following the 2018 midterm elections. And those statements are having an impact on faith in democracy and a sense of the importance of the democratic process. So we've seen that 52% of Republicans, according to one poll, would potentially support postponing the 2020 elections if the president called for it. At the same time, he's taken steps that seem to be invitations for his supporters to engage in voter intimidation. So he's not only repeated false accusations about rampant voter fraud, but he's actually invited his supporters to go to the polls to supervise what might be happening on election day. We think that reflects a sort of very worrying pattern that starts to echo things that we've seen in foreign countries when democratic states have started to decline into a less democratic form of government. That often starts with an elected leader holding scheduled elections, but doing things to make sure that the outcome of that election is not really in doubt. So that's what we're sort of concerned about preventing here in the United States.
So I want to ask you about the title. The title is rather coyly refers in the abstract to a corrupt president. But within the first paragraph or so of the report, and immediately in your answer to my first question, you guys are talking about Donald Trump. And so my question is, how much of an abstract policy analysis and proposal is this? And how much is really this president raises certain specific concerns that we need to think about in the context of 2020?
Look, we're obviously writing this sort of in response to things that are happening today, but we don't think that this risk ends if President Trump leaves office in 2020. Obviously, the social conditions that made him an appealing candidate to so many Americans are not going to be solved by a single election. And it strikes us as perfectly plausible that another candidate who shares, let's say, President Trump's authoritarian leanings could be elected at some point in the future. So when we think about policy reforms to strengthen the guardrails on our elections from this type of partisan influence or partisan attack, we're thinking just as much about future presidents as we are about President Trump.
All right. So let's talk about what Trump has done to raise these red flags for you. So at a certain level, I mean, a lot of it is sort of the way he talks, right? He's mean and he doesn't talk the way a normal politician talks. And he doesn't say certain things that constitute kind of genuflections to the rules as we understand them traditionally. For example, saying that you'll accept the results of the election if you lose, or, you know, if the majority of people in a jurisdiction vote against you, you don't question without some pretty good reason their right to do that or their entitlement to vote. But you go further than that and you describe a pattern of behavior that raises questions about whether we can have a free and fair presidential election. So I want you to lay out what the components of that case are, that there's really a policy problem here rather than just, you know, a personality who doesn't like to lose or acknowledge the possibility of his losing. Make the case that there's a policy problem that I should be worried about, and then I will challenge you on some of the components of that case.
Sure. So I think one thing we can compare when we think about, is this just words or is this action, is the words that the president used in 2016 and how he's been able to at least suggest that he might turn those into actions in 2020. So obviously his sort of campaign rallying cry in 2016 was lock her up. At that point, that was notional. He didn't have the power to lock her up. But the president has taken the position that he, as chief executive, also has unlimited authority to direct DOJ to open investigations or close investigations. So when he and his allies start spreading initially rumors that Joe and Hunter Biden had been engaged in some kind of criminal behavior in Ukraine, and when he publicly says that it would be acceptable for him to direct the attorney general to open an investigation into the Bidens, that is much more significant than the sort of just words that we saw in 2016. And this is a tactic that we've seen abroad. So President Putin in Russia has routinely used criminal charges against his political opponents as a way to discredit those opponents in the eyes of the public. And we really worry that something like that could happen here. And the president, sort of through his role at the head of the executive branch, his words have much more power than they did even when he was a presidential candidate.
Okay, so I want to stop you there because, so I have argued that the president's calling for the criminal prosecution of Hillary Clinton is a discrete impeachable offense. And so I sort of yield to nobody to take it in taking it seriously as a very, very bad thing. But I also don't quite understand how it affects the ability to hold a fair election. That is, it's not like 25 Democrats haven't lined up to run against him, no doubt aware that he might call for their criminal prosecution. And so when I think about that in the context of your report, I sort of scratch my head a little bit and I say, okay, I understand that this is a completely unacceptable, corrupt behavior for the president to engage in. I understand, I even think he should be impeached and removed from office for doing this sort of thing on a repeated basis. But I am not certain that I understand why it tilts the electoral playing field in his favor or makes him, it's a grotesque abuse of power, but why does it make the election unfair or disreputable?
I think you're maybe underestimating the effect that the president or a top DOJ official going out in public and saying there is an ongoing investigation into this presidential candidate, or even there should be an investigation into this presidential candidate, would have on voters, especially maybe voters who aren't paying attention at this point in time or aren't closely tapped into the race right now. I think it's going to be very hard for a candidate to effectively rebut that kind of allegation, especially if it's made, say, close in time to the election. And I think that's where thinking about this in a foreign context is especially helpful. If we heard that the leader of another country had launched a criminal investigation into his or her opponent on flimsy grounds, in the weeks or months ahead of a major election, I think we would react rightly with shock and horror. And I think we shouldn't let sort of our own comfort with American rule of law overshadow that reaction when it comes to the domestic context.
Okay, so that's interesting. You're drawing then, I guess, a distinction between actually doing it, or at least I had been mentally drawing a distinction between actually doing it. Surely, if the president launched a criminal investigation against Joe Biden or his son for political reasons in the context at all for political reasons, but particularly in the context of an election, I agree with you. We would see it right in exactly in that framework. But I had been drawing a distinction between kind of casually talking about it and actually doing it. And what you're saying is that actually there's kind of a continuum between one and the other.
Exactly. This president talks very casually, and I think the temptation to dismiss is to say, it's just another tweet. But even this president's words carry distinctive weight. And I think, especially to the extent that he's able to bring in other branches of government or agencies within the government to sort of seemingly support his point of view, the more persuasive of an effect they might have on voters and the more dangerous the abuse of power is.
So your second area of concern is delegitimizing opposition candidate victories. Walk us through that one.
Sure. So as I mentioned before, in the wake of the 2016 election, the president claimed that he would have won the popular vote, was it not for millions of illegal votes that were cast for Hillary Clinton. And he actually tried to enlist the apparatus of government to support those claims. The Pence-Kobach Commission was created to investigate these supposed claims of voter fraud. It ultimately was disbanded, thanks in part to the scrutiny of outside groups, including Protect Democracy. But again, not before the damage to Americans' faith in democracy was done. Similarly, we saw that after the 2018 midterm elections, when officials across the country were engaged in a very normal process of continuing to count ballots after election day, because absentee ballots come arrive after election day that are entitled to be counted. Military ballots come in after election day that are entitled to be counted. The president, you know, repeatedly and with respect to several different states, suggested that that vote counting process was illegitimate. Our democracy depends on voters having faith in the electoral process, and in particular that their votes are going to be counted accurately. The president using his bully pulpit to cast doubt on that process is really dangerous for the long-term stability of our democracy, especially to the extent that he would ever say that a candidate who won the election wasn't actually the legitimate victor, because I think that would tee up a really potentially dangerous situation.
But again, help me with the modalities here, because this one, unlike the, you know, trying to get an investigation of a political opponent, is really just the president talking, right? He didn't do anything to try to prevent the election of people who he didn't like in 2018. He complained about all these illegal immigrants voting in 2016, and he set up a commission to study it that was kind of ill-fated. And all of that was gross, but he didn't actually do anything. And so I guess my question on this one is the argument that the talk is itself pernicious, with which I certainly agree, by the way, or that there is something more that went on here than simply the president venting?
So first, I agree with you. The talk is pernicious, but I think he has gone a little bit farther. And here, the apparatus that he is using is not the government, but it's his supporters out in the world. So he, at a rally in Pennsylvania before the 2016 election, urged a crowd to go to Philadelphia to monitor the polls to prevent the election from being stolen. First, I think the racial subtext here is significant. He was talking to a white crowd, and he was talking about polling stations in predominantly Black communities. That the historical echoes are deafening when it comes to folks setting up a presence at the polls that's intended to deter minority voters from turning out. And that is classic voter intimidation. In many cases, it may already be unlawful if any of his supporters were to actually listen to him and go to the polls with that intention in mind. And it's also in this overheated political climate with the amount of political violence that we've seen in recent times really dangerous.
Okay, so you've kind of drifted into your third category here, which is intimidating voters for other candidates. But is there more to say on that one? I agree with you that there is certainly a climate of some of his rhetoric at some of the rallies that is, shall we say, friendly to voter intimidation or voter dissuasion. What else has he done in that regard?
So I think the thing that we can't draw a clear line between the president's actions and what happened last year in El Paso with respect to Customs and Border Protection, but it's the kind of thing that makes us very worried about what could happen in the future.
You mean last week, right?
Oh, no, I actually mean in 2018. So on the day before Election Day in 2018, Customs and Border Protection announced that they were going to do a crowd control exercise on Election Day. So that's a sort of visible display of law enforcement power in a heavily Latino community on Election Day. We don't have any indication that that was directed by the president, and it was ultimately called off on Election Day after some outcry from civil rights groups. But we think that's an illustration of how the president could use immigration enforcement, which he has really used as a political tool throughout his presidency, in a way that's designed to specifically target the election and voter participation. So that's something that we're also, you know, is targeted by our proposals and something that we'll be keeping an active eye on going into 2020.
So your fourth category is creating an emergency to spark voter fears. I am interested in this one because it brings together a number of themes that, you know, you guys have talked about in other contexts as well. But I'm, you know, one thing when I think about the Declaration of National Emergency in connection with building the border wall, one thing I don't think about is influencing elections, except in the very limited sense that it's a matter of genuine commitment between the president and his base voters. And there's clearly some energize the base dimension, or at least keep faith with your promises to the base, as well as, I think, some genuine conviction on the president's part with respect to it. But why do you see this in the context of a electoral manipulation in the president's, using the presidency to affect votes in your own favor?
To be clear, I don't think we're saying here that all of the border wall and border emergency rhetoric is election manipulation. I agree with you that that's sort of part of the president's message and maybe something he has genuine beliefs about that goes beyond an effort to manipulate the election. But I think if you look at what happened in 2018, the timing of the sort of rhetoric about the caravan and the decision to send troops to the border, frankly, with very little strategic purpose, that decision was made right before the midterm election. And very shortly after the election, the administration started to make noise about pulling the troops back without, I think, much evidence that circumstances at the border had really changed. And that makes it look like the decision to send troops, which I think when you hear about the United States sending troops somewhere, that, you know, if you're not so fundamentally deeply cynical about the administration's actions, make you think, oh, there's a serious danger that they must be responding to, seems designed to spark fear in a potentially really dangerous way. I think when you hear about concerns that the president might sort of start a war for political purposes, that's a variant on the same worry. But I think what we saw with respect to sending troops to the border last year was that worry to some extent being realized.
And is your contention, your section on this is quite brief and describes basically what you just described, but I guess my question is the concern specific that we will have another kind of caravan situation, a sort of ginned up southern border, quote unquote, crisis in order to facilitate a sort of flamboyant displays of presidential leadership by, say, sending troops or taking some action? Or is the concern more general that of creating some emergency-like situation that is sort of contrived for political purposes? In other words, is this a border-specific thing, or is it a kind of like, what we used to call a wag the dog without this personal scandal dimension, a kind of wag the dog scenario?
I think it is more a more general wag the dog type fear, although given the centrality of the border to the president's political message, it wouldn't be surprising if the emergency ended up being sort of border related once again.
All right. So your last category is provocatively entitled colluding with a foreign government to interfere with the election, which if, you know, we had a Trump supporter here, that person might reasonably point out, wait a minute, there was no collusion, or maybe not so reasonably point that out. But I mean, one thing that, you know, the Mueller report did not find was knowing collusion, at least as the term is used in the or not used in the report. And so I guess I'm interested in your justification for the inclusion of that as one of the things that we should be concerned that Donald Trump will engage in the 2020 election.
So we, first of all, acknowledge in the white paper that Mueller did not find evidence of direct collusion or conspiracy between the campaign and the Russian government. But I think the president's own words here are pretty damning. As you know, he recently told George Stephanopoulos that he would freely accept information about a political opponent from a foreign country. He's also had a number of interactions with President Putin in particular that I think should be concerning to outside observers in terms of sort of wanting to meet one-on-one with minimal, I want to say supervision, although I don't think that's the right word, minimal participation by U.S. government officials who might look askance if improper communications were had. So I think the pattern of conduct from the president has to at least raise the question of what he would do if a foreign government offered him electoral assistance going into 2020.
All right. You guys make five proposals to having painted this picture of concern. You guys present five proposals to remediate it, although you start out by saying it's only partially remediable because actually there are these things that you really can't take away from the president the power to do. And so I want to start actually before we talk about the five proposals, like, what's the part of this problem that's inherent to the, I don't mean to you know, in inherent authority, but there is some degree of inherent presidential authority to screw up elections, right? And I guess I'm interested in, before you get to the things that you think can be addressed, what's the part of it that, like, if you have an authoritarian president, he's just going to be able to do?
So, you know, I think you were really pressing the point, sort of so many of the things we describe in the first part of the paper at least start out as being just words. And Congress is never going to be able to take the president's bully pulpit away. And there is a lot that someone in that role can do to shape the way that Americans think about their elections and sort of what they believe about their elections that regulation is not going to be able to address. You know, some of these proposals try to curb some of the potential downstream effects of that bully pulpit, but ultimately the president, you can't take that away from any president.
If the president wants to say that the election isn't legitimate, there's nothing you can do about that, right?
I don't want to say nothing, but I think there's very, when it comes to sort of things that Congress could do, I think it would be very hard to effectively sort of prevent the president from that kind of loose talk. I think in the wag the dog scenario, it may be difficult for Congress to really effectively curb all of the ways the president could create an emergency that he would then need to respond to. But I think there are a number of different ways that the president can be constrained, and that also that lower level officials in the administration who would have to participate in certain efforts to interfere with the election could also be constrained and deterred.
All right. So let's talk about your five proposals. The first one is to protect political candidates from improper law enforcement activity. How do you propose to do that?
So one of the, I think, central lessons from the investigation into the Clinton email scandal is that if you read the OIG report on that investigation, it reveals that there are some norms within DOJ about investigations into candidates for political office, but they are mostly norms and there is not necessarily even agreement within the department about what those norms mean. So our goal here was to just strengthen first the role for career officials in the public integrity section to ensure that they had a role to play in providing advice on when investigations into political candidates are appropriate and properly justified, and to make sure that those views are documented. And then also to strengthen oversight of DOJ, both by its own Office of Inspector General and Office of Professional Responsibility, but also, when it's possible, getting key congressional leaders sort of read into the investigation for an additional layer of oversight.
So when you talk about expanding the range of people who have to be consulted before you can take major investigative steps with respect to candidate, family, political committee, this has an ironic sound to me, because one of the things it sounds like is the way some of Trump's defenders have complained about the investigative scrutiny that people associated with the Trump campaign received in 2016 in the Russia investigation. So I'm curious to what extent you've thought about how the rule you're proposing would have affected the Russia investigation back then, or is the theory that that investigation was sufficiently well predicated that whatever degree of oversight you create for it, it would have done just fine?
I don't want to make any claims about sort of the extent to which that investigation was or was not well predicated, but what our proposal essentially does is take the DOJ policy that's in place with respect to campaign finance crimes and extend it to other types of criminal activity. So ensuring that there's appropriate oversight into investigations into political candidates should be something that we think is important, whether we like the candidate who's being investigated or not. And when it comes to getting input from career officials into the appropriateness of the investigation, I think that's sort of the best way to insulate a potentially contentious investigation from the kind of criticism that it's gotten subsequently.
So proposal number two is to prevent voter intimidation by all law enforcement officers, including those who assist in enforcing immigration laws. Again, how do you propose to do that?
So here, I think we propose more black and white lines than we do with respect to investigations into political candidates. Immigration enforcement is rarely a matter of sort of emergency public safety, which is not to say that it isn't important, but just it's rarely about protecting public safety. So we think it's appropriate to say that immigration enforcement is something that just should not be happening at polling places, in the same way that some have called for a ban on immigration enforcement at courthouses and other sensitive locations. We also think that the immigration enforcement agencies should be somewhat conservative or limited in terms of what kinds of visible enforcement activities they can take on election day. So this would prevent the type of crowd control exercise that I mentioned earlier that was proposed in El Paso for election day 2018. There's simply no reason that kind of conduct had to happen on election day, and it has a potentially serious deterrent effect on voter participation, especially among communities of color. And finally, it ensures some amount of oversight, again, by the ombuds people within the Department of Homeland Security and the relevant congressional committees when DHS proposes to undertake some kind of publicly visible immigration enforcement on a voting day, and sort of ensures that there's a cooling off period between when that's announced and the actual election day, so that concerns can be raised about the effect that such actions might have on the voting public.
Proposal number three, which kind of overlaps with number two, although I suppose it doesn't involve law enforcement officers, is a federal prohibition on practices intended to deceive voters and a strengthening of existing prohibitions on voter intimidation. So we've just talked about voter intimidation, but talk to us about prohibitions on practices intended to deceive voters.
So I think that we've seen and especially as the internet has been used more and more to spread political messages and political information, an uptick in false information being spread, even about simple things like who's eligible to vote, or what the penalties might be if you make a mistake somewhere in the voting process. And that kind of false information can, again, have a serious deterrent effect on voters, and is something that we think the federal government should take action to stop. And this is something, we're not the first people to call for this. There have been bills introduced, I think, since Barack Obama introduced a similar bill when he was in the Senate to try to curb this kind of practice. But the sort of uptick we've seen in sort of intimidating voter intimidation as well as voter deception, I think, makes it clear that the time for that kind of legislation has arrived.
All right. But this does not seem responsive to the particular problem of an authoritarian-minded president's engagement with an election. After all, lots of entities spread around misinformation to voters. That problem is quite old, and it's not something that, you know, Trump in particular or the presidency in general is, you know, sort of particularly engaged in. And so I'm wondering, doesn't it seem a little bit more like a general kind of election integrity measure than a sort of response to the concerns that Trump's engagement with elections particularly raise?
This is a problem that predated Trump, but it's also a problem that I think is exacerbated by the kind of overheated rhetoric about voter fraud and illegality in elections that the president has played a crucial role in spreading. So I think there is a connection between the president's statements about elections and the effect that those have on folks in the communities who might be spurred on by that to engage more in voter deception and voter intimidation.
All right. So this, the fourth proposal also seems to me to be a little bit more general than the contemporary problem, which is to make it possible for victims of unconstitutional government interferences in elections to obtain money damages. So I think of, like, of all the things Donald Trump is going to be deterred by in engaging the electoral process in an inappropriate fashion, I find it hard to believe that the threat of money damages is going to be high on that list. Am I missing something here?
No, you're not wrong. The president is not likely to be deterred by the possibility of a Bivens lawsuit against him.
Especially because he has Nixon v. Fitzgerald immunity.
I think, though, that misses a key point we're trying to make here, which is that some of the things that the president could do to interfere with the election, like, say, using immigration enforcement officials to engage in voter intimidation or asking them to do so, requires the cooperation of other people within the government. And those individuals might be deterred by the prospect of a successful lawsuit against them in the way that the president would not be.
All right. So proposal number five, which should be named the Kellyanne Conway Act, is to strengthen disciplinary procedures in the Hatch Act for certain high-level employees. I assume you wrote that specifically with Kellyanne Conway in mind.
She's obviously the front and center example of this, but it goes to a problem that we've seen regularly in the Trump administration, which is president and the political supporters that he has understandably installed as government aides, not understanding the difference between their role as government officials and their role as political supporters. This goes again to the question of voters' faith in the integrity of their government and of the political process. When someone is a White House employee and when they're acting in their capacity as a White House employee, they are repositories of the public trust. And for them to use that White House role and that White House bully pulpit to spread a political message really undermines the idea that government is about the good of the people and not just the good of one political party or one political person.
All right. Your last proposal, again, with the provocative headline, prevent the president from colluding with foreign powers. How can you prevent the president from colluding with foreign powers beyond what is already illegal?
I think you can make it harder for him to do so in a couple of ways. So first, you know, we support proposals that are already out there that would require campaigns to disclose their contacts with foreign governments. But second, we recognize that the president is unlikely to be having conversations with foreign leaders completely alone, and that other government officials are likely to be participants in those conversations. And raising the stakes for other government officials may be able to prevent that type of collusion or coordination, but at a minimum, we can increase the likelihood that it is disclosed to the public ahead of the election so that voters can make an informed decision about the person who is seeking a second term in office. So our proposal would, it's already unlawful for the president or indeed any other candidate for federal office to accept things of value from foreigners and foreign countries. Our proposal would make it unlawful for other government officials to participate in that kind of violation. And it would also create a whistleblower mechanism to ensure that officials who became aware of that type of interaction could come forward safely to Congress or the public with that information.
So to wrap up, I guess I'm interested in your sort of gestalt sense of how concerned you are at this stage about the integrity of the election we're going to have in this country in less than a year and a half, and how much these proposals, if actually implemented, would in fact alleviate your concerns. I mean, where are you on a scale on if the alarmometer goes from 0 to 10? Where are you now, and where would you be if I snapped my fingers and invoked my remarkable powers of godly powers to implement all your proposals? How much would that needle move?
Would that you had such powers, Ben.
I agree. But let us both indulge the happy fantasy.
Look, I think it is still, you know, more likely than not that we are going to have sort of a fair election in the next year. And there, the threats that I am worried about when I think about 2020 are not just in this bucket. But if you could snap your fingers and implement these proposals, I think it would actually accomplish two things. One, the proposals would meaningfully constrain the president from and his supporters and potential allies within the government from some of the paths towards influencing the election that we're most worried about. But it would also send a signal to the American public that we share the value of an election with a fair playing field. I think one sort of long-term danger to democracy is that we are losing the sense, the sort of shared sense, that a fair playing field is something that we should all value. So I think we've actually seen problems on the state level that parallel the types of problems that this white paper is focused on. So, for example, Protect Democracy last year represented Georgia voters seeking to disqualify then Secretary of State Brian Kemp from overseeing his own election when it got to the recount stage, because he had, through sort of repeated decisions in the pre-election context, shown that he was willing to use his powers to shape the electorate and shape the playing field for his gubernatorial race to ensure that he would win. That's just one example of a pattern that I think we've seen recur. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're concerned about this from President Trump, that this sense that the importance of a fair playing field is somewhat degraded on both the state and federal levels.
One last question, and then I'll let you go. You know, over the last few weeks, at least two Democratic candidates, Kamala Harris and Julian Castro, have publicly entertained the idea that President Trump should be prosecuted in their administrations. And I think and I'm paraphrasing, but Kamala Harris really basically called for him to be prosecuted and said it would happen in her administration and later sort of backed down a little bit from that. And Julian Castro at one of the debates said, hey, you know, I know you're not supposed to, we're not supposed to say what would happen in our Justice Departments, but I can't imagine that he wouldn't be prosecuted was kind of the tone of it. And so I am wondering to what extent you see echoes of any of these behaviors that you're concerned about in the president on the other side, and to what extent, if you do see them, they are simply just less threatening because the individuals in question are not the president, or to what extent we should be as concerned about them or almost as concerned about them because they reflect, you know, the contagion of the disease.
These people are, you know, as presidential candidates, are potential future presidents. So I absolutely, we think we should be taking what they say seriously. And, you know, we certainly at Protect Democracy have called on all of the presidential candidates to be very clear that they would appoint an attorney general who would act independently of the White House and would insulate the Department of Justice's investigative and prosecutorial decision making from any kind of political influence. We think it's absolutely critical that all of the candidates for president in 2020 make very clear that they are going to make more robust and reinstall the norms of nonpartisan law enforcement that the country has always at least aspired to.
The paper is Play Fair, How to Prevent a Corrupt President from Tipping the Playing Field in His Own Election. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. It was my pleasure.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you're interested in hearing more on this topic, Erica Newland of Protect Democracy will discuss the paper further in a post on lawfareblog.com on Saturday. If you have a second, please share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited and produced by Jen Patia Howell. I was your audio engineer this week, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.